Yeah, so I'm going to talk about GRB jets and things that happen when they have more structure, or we're looking at them at weird at angles that we sort of weren't expecting in years past. And then, yeah, so to get us started, I'm going to give a brief primer on gamma ray bursts as a whole. I'll talk about how they how their emission depends on the on our viewing angle, how this can affect some of our conclusions about their population. I'm going to go into jet structure and specifically how this relates to the famous 17817 binary neutron star merger from a few years ago. Talk about my code Afterglow Pi, and then a bit about looking to the future and some things we've done with these models. And a lot of this is based on sort of this big paper that sort of summed up most of my work of the last few couple of years, which is in AppJ. And so let's get started. GRBs and their afterglows. I always like starting with this image. This is the night sky, and we're all theorists here, for the most part, I think. But it's always nice to remember that, you know, everything I'm talking about here are things that if we just sort of look up from our paper every once in a while, they're all up there somewhere. These are real objects that we're trying to study. This is the night sky in the optical. I'm going to be talking a lot of my work actually happens in the X-rays, where the night sky looks like this. This is actually a very recent image from eRosita. It just finished its first all sky survey. And so this is a beautiful image. You know, you can see sort of just pick out neutron stars and black holes at a glance. But of course, gamma ray bursts depend on gamma rays. So this is what the sky looks like in gamma rays. We can see the galactic plane, all these point sources from AGN and the like. And there's this, and every once in a while, if you're staring out at the gamma ray sky, if you have an older telescope, your image might look a little bit more like this. And then every once in a while, something like this happens. There is a brief flash of gamma rays that blank out the entire gamma ray sky. It saturates your detector, and this is a gamma ray burst. So gamma ray bursts are these luminous explosions. They are brief. They last for seconds, sometimes minutes. They are brighter than the entire gamma ray sky. They occur at cosmological distances, and they are tied to the deaths of massive stars and the mergers of compact objects. These days, we have several satellites that are dedicated to studying these things. They occur about daily, every couple days, depending on sort of detector efficiencies and things. And so we see and record, you know, on the order of 100 of these per year. They're happening all the time. And despite sort of decades of study, we actually still don't know where the gamma rays come from. We know there are explosions. We know that there are jets. They're ultra relativistic. We know a lot about these objects, but one thing we don't know is the specific mechanism that actually produces the gamma rays. Interestingly enough, I actually don't study gamma ray bursts, the prompt gamma rays themselves. I study more of their afterglows. Afterglows are long-lived counterparts to GRBs. The gamma rays themselves only last for a few seconds. Afterglows can last for days, weeks, months. 17817, we've been following for 3 years now. They're broadband, so you see them in radio, you see them in optical, you see them in X-rays and gamma rays. It's non-thermal emission. It's mainly synchrotron, entirely synchrotron as far as we know. And afterglows are really useful for a whole lot of reasons. Originally, they were most useful for IDing host galaxies. Sort of when we first discovered GRBs in the 70s, we didn't know what was causing them at all. And it wasn't until because our gamma ray telescopes didn't have fine enough angular resolution to actually identify a host. But with afterglows, we could follow them up with optical telescopes and see that GRBs were actually coming from distant galaxies. And this was sort of the first sort of rock solid confirmation that these are cosmological objects. And if they're so far away, they have to be incredibly bright for us to see them. the whole picture, this is sort of the cartoon of a gamma ray burst and its afterglow. I use this image all the time, and I've never been able to find who made it. So if anyone knows who made this image, please, I would like to replace this credit unknown at the bottom. So a GRB starts out with some sort of progenitor object. This progenitor object is a massive star that's collapsing, or the merger of a couple of neutron stars. And through this merger, somehow they form a jet, an ultra-relativistic jet that starts very close to this engine. This jet propagates out of the object and out through space. In the process, it emits gamma rays, either through sort of colliding with sort of different shock fronts internally to this blast wave, or sort of through collisions with the external medium. Eventually, this jet begins sweeping up material in the surrounding medium. It expands through orders of magnitude through the interstellar medium away from its host star. It sweeps up more and more ISM and starts driving a shockwave. The shockwave or blast wave ends up producing synchrotron emission. Synchrotron emission is emission from relativistic electrons being accelerated through magnetic fields. So as this shockwave sort of rips through the ISM, the front of the shockwave has a little bit of turbulence. This turbulence spins up a magnetic field. The electrons start bouncing through this magnetic field and the interstellar medium. They get accelerated into a non-thermal population. So you have these hot relativistic electrons bouncing through this magnetic field, and they start emitting synchrotron radiation, which we see on Earth. This is the whole story. I've said that there's a couple progenitors for these things. GRBs are generally come in two categories. We call them short GRBs and long GRBs. Short GRBs last for less than 2 seconds. Long GRBs last for more than 2 seconds. The long GRBs are we are very sure come from collapsars, which is another word for a massive star undergoing a supernova. We know this because whenever long GRBs happen nearby, and the situation is right that we can follow it up, we almost always see a supernova that occurs at the same spot in the sky a few days or weeks after the GRB. So we know those are connected, massive stars. Short GRBs come from binary neutron star mergers, and this was sort of mostly, this was sort of had really good grounding. It was mostly theoretical until 3 years ago, when LIGO first discovered 72817 and saw gravitational waves from binary neutron stars. That was followed up by a short GRB, and we're going to hear a lot about this story over the next hour, and I'm sure you've heard lots since. This 2 second cutoff is empirical. You can see from this distribution of GRB durations, it's not really a hard limit. There could be some sort of long short bursts and short long bursts, you know, but these populations are pretty well separated. So this is a pretty good sort of way of saying which burst is which. Both of these progenitor models, the collapsar and the binary neutron star merger, both somehow have to produce a ultra-relativistic jet. We know from the gamma rays, these things need Lorentz factors, most of the time in the hundreds, sometimes 1,000, at the very least for short GRBs in the tens. And the central engine is very mysterious. All we really know is that it must produce an ultra-relativistic jet. There's some process that happens when neutron stars merge or large stars explode that produces some sort of ultra-relativistic jet. We don't know what this process is. There's many models, many theories. Some work better than others. Most common one is that it's a black hole. We know black holes can launch jets. We see it all the time in from AGN, from X-ray binaries. Black holes make very good candidates. There's a large energy supply. These things are fed by some sort of accretion process, and so they can sort of continuously pump out these jets. So you can, this is a very good model for a central engine. But there's also a lot of proponents of the magnetar model. We know when if you merge two neutron stars, you can make a, you can sometimes make a highly magnetized remnant, even if it's only around for a little bit. When stars collapse, you also can form a neutron star for a long or short period of time. Magnetars are sort of young neutron stars with immensely strong magnetic fields. In these cases, these would be neutron stars that are spinning incredibly rapidly. So you can think about it like an like sort of a super pulsar, a crazy energetic object, huge magnetic field, spinning very rapidly. These can also produce jets. They're limited in their rotational energy, which is sort of the one of our more quantitative predictions of these models. We think these magnetars can only supply about 2 × 10^52 ergs of energy. And there are suggestions that sort of their jets may be less collimated than black hole jets, but they're going to interact with ejecta and things, and so it's hard to know. One point in favor of the magnetar model is that the X-ray emission from GRBs is very complicated. There are flares and plateaus and all sorts of different emission processes, and it's a lot easier to imagine ways that some sort of like violent hot neutron star can produce all of these X-rays, and it's sort of easier to think of ways magnetars can do that than black holes can do that. These are both good models, and we really don't know one way or the other at this point, and it would be great to find out. And this is sort of the end goal of a lot of the work I'm trying to do. It's hard to, unfortunately, we can't just look at the central engine and see what it is because it's surrounded by its progenitor. Either you have two neutron stars that merge and surrounded by a massive sort of cloud of ejecta, or you have a massive star that's collapsing and sort of hidden down in the center of this is the central engine, but we can't see that. We see its gamma rays and its afterglow that are emitted, many orders of magnitude further away. If we can track what the jet produces and understand its output, we can hopefully sort of understand the final states of this evolution and sort of track that back to figure out what the initial stage was. So as the central engine produces a jet, this jet breaks out of its host object and starts ripping through the ISM. And this procedure looks something like this. This is a numerical simulation, relativistic numerical hydrodynamics. On the left, we see the energy density in a blast wave. This was a blast wave that was sort of highly collimated at first. On the right-hand side, we see its lateral velocity. We see it starts as this sort of tight, relativistically thinned shock wave that sort of slows and broadens with time. This simulation was actually done in a Lorentz boosted frame, so we could see the early time evolution. And so our frame actually is going faster than the jet at this point, and the jet backs away. This object, even if we don't understand the central engine, we do understand shock waves and blast waves very well. We can just do simulations like this by the thousands, and understand the emission processes of objects like this. A blast wave like that, it's emits synchrotron radiation from the jet surface. Synchrotron radiation has a spectrum that looks like this image on the left. I've highlighted a couple bands here. The green band is sort of a typical radio frequency, the blue band is a typical optical frequency, and the purple band is a typical X-ray frequency. And the spectrum is a little complicated. We have a few different power law segments depending on sort of what the frequency of radiation we're seeing and how that compares to the frequencies of the electrons in their motion and their Lorentz factors. This peak here at the top of the spectrum has to do with the frequency of electrons at the Lorentz factor. They're sort of injected and they are accelerated to higher Lorentz factors, which gives you the higher energy emission. With time, these characteristic frequencies in the spectrum change. This injection frequency and this over here is the cooling frequency. They will change with time, as does the sort of overall flux from this thing. On the right-hand side, we're gonna see a light curve. This is the flux with time, and I'm just gonna play this so we can see what happens. So with time, these frequencies tend to shift down as the electrons cool, Lorentz factors drop, and we observe light curves. This is flux as a function of time. We're gonna see a lot of these on the right-hand side that look like this. There is a, there's a few features here. The optical X-ray and radio at early times all have different slopes. The optical and X-ray are pretty similar. Radio is very different. This is because they're seeing different parts of the synchrotron spectrum. They all cut at the same point at late times. This is a thing called a jet break. The jet break is a very useful feature. We're gonna talk about it a lot more. And this is often how we measure how wide jets are. This is a geometric effect that has to do with the jet decelerating, its Lorentz factor dropping to the point where sort of beaming isn't as effective and we can see the entire jet surface. And we'll talk a lot about more of that, a lot more about that in a second. The jet break, because it's a geometric effect, it affects all the bands in the same way. Whereas in early times, we see they all have these different structures because they're seeing different parts of the synchrotron spectrum. The details are important. The jet break, the details are a little bit less important. It happens to everything at the same time, which is a very nice signature in observational data. So this is the this is sort of the classic picture of a GRB afterglow. If you looked up GRBs in a textbook a few years ago, this is sort of what you would see. On the left-hand panel here, we're staring straight down at a GRB jet that's coming directly towards us. We're assuming we're on axis, so we're looking straight down the jet axis. This pale circle, it'll get darker in a second, is the jet surface. The color represents the Lorentz factor. And because it's moving relativistically towards us, relativistic beaming is very important. The emission from objects moving with high Lorentz factors is sort of beamed in the direction of their motion. So everything outside of the circle is moving so fast in a direction away from us that we essentially don't see it at all. And everything inside the circle is stuff. So we're inside its beaming cone. So it's material that we can see. On the right-hand side, you see a light curve that will fill in as I run this. So with time, the GRB decelerates, the Lorentz factor drops, and this circle, so that's from the beginning again, and the circle gets wider. As Lorentz factor drops, we can see more and more of the jet because this beaming effect becomes less and less strong. At some point, the beaming becomes, the beaming angle becomes comparable to the size of the jet itself. And at that point, there's no more material entering our frame of view, and the emission starts to drop faster than it was before. And we get a steeper evolution. And you can do these calculations analytically and get predictions for the power loss slope of this section, the power loss slope of this section. The time at which this jet break happens depends on this angle and the angle opening angle of the jet. And it turns out it goes like the 1/3 power. This is very useful. We've been using this for years to try to measure the sizes of these jets by looking at this jet break. But of course, the chances of actually looking at a GRB jet straight down the jet axis are essentially zero. These things are distributed isotropically in the sky, pointing in all directions. So we are more likely to see GRBs sort of from somewhere inside this jet cone. So we have to put a few more numbers and names on things now. This jet has a central engine, and we're gonna call its the energy it releases on axis, we're gonna call that E0, and it has an opening angle theta C. This is the angle of the core. It expands into a local ISM with some sort of number density of particles, N0. And we have some extra parameters for the synchrotron emission that detail sort of the population of hot electrons and the strength of the magnetic field and this sort of thing. We won't go into too much detail into that. And now we're going to consider what happens if the Earth is a little off axis at some viewing angle like this. So now same picture again, but our viewing cone is a little bit offset over here. And same picture as before, the beam decelerates, we see more and more, except we see the one edge of the jet before we see the other edge of the jet. So this makes for a slower evolution. We see the same initial behavior. We see the same final behavior once the whole jet comes into play, but there's some sort of smoothing that happened that interpolates between these two limits, and the difference between these two times depends on both the opening angle and the viewing angle, again, to this 8/3 power. And so this is some work that I did during my PhD. We knew that this was a potential effect, and one thing this can do is if you don't take this into account, if I go back here, if you don't take this into account, this first break is fairly weak. You don't see this. So if you were just sort of squinting at this data, you might think that only this break down here was where the jet break happened. And if you weren't taking into account viewing angle, which very few people did until a few years ago, you might expect that you were looking at this on axis and that this were the jet break down at the end here. And you would assume a larger opening angle than there actually was. When we measure these jet breaks, we really see the opening angle plus the viewing angle. We don't see just the opening angle itself. And so without taking this into account, you might be misinterpreting your data. So during my PhD, we knew this was a potential effect. And I wrote a piece of software called ScaleFit. ScaleFit takes numerical simulation data, like the simulation I just showed you, and computes. It takes this data, computes template light curves based, and then it can interpolate between these light curves very quickly to construct light curves on the fly. Actually, going from one of these simulations to an observed light curve is relatively complicated because it's moving relativistically towards you. Different parts of the jet are going to contribute emission at different observer times. And so to get all of the emission, to get your entire flux for one observer time, you need to integrate over many different simulation times to get a complete picture. This is a very time-consuming process in general, so we pre-compute everything into a whole bunch of template banks. And then we can interpolate between the templates. And with this, we were able to fit actually a large number of GRBs with a simulation-based model. We could compute the simulations each took, a number of days on a supercomputer, but once we had everything tabulated, we could compute afterglows in like a millisecond and by really quickly scaling different parameters. This is a fit to a particular GRB. This is sort of the first real data you're seeing. This is an X-ray light curve with some features. We were able to plug this into a fancy Bayesian Markov chain Monte Carlo parameter estimation software, and we're able to measure the viewing angle and the opening angle and all sorts of things. And we were able to get the opening angle sort of unbiased by this viewing angle effect.
Can I ask, so in these fits, are you fitting to multiple different bands at the same time or just like the X-ray?
These fits were only to the X-rays, which really limited what we could do because there's many parameters in these models, as you saw. There's sort of seven or eight generically. And if you're only looking at the X-ray, you're only seeing one part of the spectrum. And so you're missing the dependence on these other parameters. And so there's a lot of degeneracies that we weren't able to resolve here. The work I'm doing now sort of fits as much data as we possibly can all over the EM spectrum.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
And so we were able to do this with this one burst, and we're also able to do it with many bursts. Most of them, because of these degeneracies, we weren't able to get great fits and constraints on. But when we were able to measure the opening angle and the viewing angle, we found sort of as you would expect that more GRBs were viewed sort of off, sort of closer to the jet edge than closer to the jet core. Theoretically, if these things were distributed isotropically and your probability of seeing them didn't depend on that, you'd expect this to be a more or less linear relationship. And this was sort of the first evidence from a population of GRBs that really there are these viewing angle effects, and that we can find them and fit them out. Now, this was all sort of pre the gravitational wave era. But we've known that LIGO was coming for a very long time. And the expectation was that gravitational wave events are going to be a way of detecting these binary neutron star mergers that we think make short GRBs. But the gravitational waves are isotropic, so we can see them from any angle. We only see the GRBs if we're on axis, or at least within the cone of the jet. So most LIGO events, we would assume, would be beamed completely away from us. So we would live somewhere outside of this jet core. And as the jet decelerates initially, we would see nothing. Everything would be beamed away until it decelerates to the point where we can see sort of one edge of the jet, and then we'd see the far edge of the jet, and then it would really quickly dive away. And this is called an orphan afterglow. And this is what we expected just about every LIGO event. If we were lucky enough to see GRB emission from a LIGO event, we would expect their afterglows to look like this. And even in this case, we have good analytic predictions of sort of the initial slope and the final slope, and we understand how this depends on viewing angle. We already had one question. Does anyone else have any questions? That's my GRB primer and viewing angles.
Well, have people seen these sort of orphan afterglows in like optical surveys, like PanSTARRS or DES?
There are a couple good candidates, but only a couple, I think. People have been looking for them. They're hard to spot because you don't see the GRB itself, so you don't sort of know when sort of T0 was. You're just looking for sort of a little flare in optical or X-rays that then disappears. So they're hard to find. There's a couple candidates, but no sort of, I don't think there's any real solid 100% detections yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then from those then like candidates, I guess then you can place an upper limit on the rate at which these orphan afterglows occur. And then compared to like the GRB rate, I guess then you can place some sort of upper limit on the jet angle.
Yeah. So we don't know if the jet angle changes from burst to burst, which is one problem. There is evidence that different bursts have different opening angles. I don't think there have been enough solid detections yet for this to be a useful calculation to do. This is certainly something, as LIGO gets more data, we will be able to do this with short GRBs, because LIGO is going to see sort of some population of binary neutron star mergers at all angles, and then we know what the GRB rate is, so we'll be able to do this sort of once LIGO has higher statistics.
Okay, but the small number of candidates combined with the large number of GRBs isn't already enough to, you know, put some interesting bound on like the typical opening angle?
I don't think so. I could be wrong. I know it's hard to, I believe it's hard to work out the observational biases in things like this. There's such variability with different models. It could just be that many GRBs are too dim, so you aren't seeing them regardless.
So Jeffrey, out of curiosity, so if you're thinking of binary neutron stars, and if one were to push even further on these open angles being different at different systems, at what point would you feel, you need to bring black hole neutron stars into the mix, given that there isn't that much variability on the type of binary neutron star systems you can think of? I mean, if you're going to assume kind of the conservative approach that we have very little spin, if any, in the neutron stars, roughly the same mass, then why would you expect open angle variability among different binary neutron stars?
That's a great question. I don't know how stochastic the process that makes this jet and how it interacts with the ejecta is. because the process of sort of sculpting out these jets and sort of to the point where they eventually produce a GRB, you produce the jet with the central engine, and then it's sculpted by whatever accretion flow is around that, and then it needs to burrow out of the ejecta cloud. And I don't know, and I can imagine there being a lot of sort of stochastic behavior sort of in that whole process. So even if you had black hole neutron stars of identical masses, I don't know if you would expect always the jets to be the same size.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I'm just trying to think what things you can play around with. Maybe the only thing that you can at the end easily point to, oh, this will induce differences is the whatever direction the dipole of the star may have. So because the matter in itself might be just might be too narrow a corner for, but anyway, so that it's interesting. Sorry, I haven't thought about it.
Yeah, no problem. And that's a great question. And ultimately, I'll get to this at the end. But you know, we don't have because you know it's difficult to do. Difficult is an understatement, but it's quite difficult to do sort of a whole simulation starting from binary neutron stars, producing a GRB ultra-relativistic jet, and then taking that all the way to the afterglow. You know, this is numerically challenging. So what we do, most of the work now is focused on just sort of parameterizing possible jets and afterglows, fitting that to the data and then seeing what we see. But it would be great to actually start pushing on tying all these things together. And you know, if it turns out that binary neutron stars only produce jets of like 6-degree widths, that would be incredible. And that would be very good to know. So structured jets. How are we doing on time? Okay, I'll speed up. There was this famous event, perhaps you've heard of it, 170817, this famous binary neutron star merger detected by LIGO. It emitted gravitational waves, which was incredible. There was a gamma ray burst 1.7 seconds later. There was a kilonova, which is this optical remnant. It's this all of this radioactive material sort of thrown out of this from the merger. It emits an optical counterpart. And there was an afterglow, which is the part that I'm most interested in. It was first detected 9 days after the burst, and then much brighter, sort of 100 days later, and we're still observing it today. So I told you what we were expecting. We were expecting all afterglows to look like this. Can I play it? Is it worth it? It's not worth it. We were expecting all afterglows to be this orphan afterglow, sort of a strong peak, plateau, and then a dip. And instead, we saw this. This is the afterglow of 1717, and it was not one of these top hat jets. These top hat jets are all these models I've shown you so far, where you have sort of uniform energy across the jet with a sharp edge. The emission we saw looked like a slow sort of power law rise. It peaked and then dipped. The peak happened at about 160 days. It rose with a slope of about 0.9. It fell with a slope of about minus 2.5. Many people all around the world were studying this. I'm sure you've seen plots like this before. We were one of the first groups, actually. I think the first group. There was a lot of argument at the very beginning as to whether or not this was a jet at all, as to whether this was a jet or some sort of more spherical, relativistic blast wave. And we were one of the first groups, sort of from our fits, we were able to point out that one way to tell the difference between these two things would be sort of this final slope, how steeply it decayed at the end. And in the end, it decayed like a jet. And there was also sort of radio emission. We were able to see the movement of this thing across the sky with very long baseline radio emission, which also confirmed it was a jet. So we know this was a jet. It was sort of a ultra-relativistic collimated source, but it looks nothing like the top hat models we were expecting. This long, slow rise followed by a regular decay. So what I sort of neglected to mention earlier is that we should really expect that all jets, every single GRB jet we have ever seen, are structured jets. Structured jet is what we call jets that have a distribution of energy with sort of angle away from the axis that is not just the step function. Step function jets are called top hat jets, and everything else is called a structured jet. And we've been simulating jets sort of breaking out of stars and being emitted through Blanford's Nyack processes and stuff for quite some time. And every single one of them shows a sort of smooth distribution of energy away from the jet axis. Many of them with power law tails, some of them a little bit sharper with a sort of Gaussian profile. And so we expect that sort of every jet in nature should really have a smooth distribution of energy. They should be structured jets. This has been ignored for a while because the idea was that, the core of the jet will be very bright, the wings of the jet will be very dim, so this top hat should be a good approximation. But it turns out that it is not so good as soon as you start changing the viewing angle. So here is a light curve. There's three different light curves drawn here. The blue is a top hat model. Orange and green are Gaussian and power law models. And sort of on the right-hand side here, you see our viewing angle with respect to the source. And what happens as you move away from the jet axis is these three models all end up looking completely different. Oh, I have to learn my controls here. As you go away from the core, when you're on axis, everything looks very, very similar except for these slight deviations near the jet break. As you go further and further off axis, you are very sensitive to the details of how energy is distributed throughout the jet. Sort of the power law has sort of a lot of early emission. Gaussians sort of rise, and top hats have this orphan afterglow behavior that funnily enough, we haven't really seen in nature too often. If you go far enough off axis, of course, all of these will look like, sorry?
Oh yeah, sorry. Do your Gaussian and the top hat have similar, similar angles, like similar opening angles, I mean?
Yes. So I picked these particular models. This is a very good point. It's sort of hard to do an apples to apples comparison between these things because there's so many different angles and parameters. These particular jets all have the same energy density at the sort of on axis, and they all have the same total energy sort of integrated over the whole jet, and they have slightly different opening angles, sort of typical angular sizes of the core to make up for this, but they have the same sort of on axis energy and the same total energy, and so their opening angles differ by an order one number. But the opening angle is sort of unknown. These are sort of jets that sort of, I picked them to produce similar early and late emission. So we can see, so if you saw this jet on axis, we really wouldn't know what it was. But off axis, these jets all look completely different.
And so at this time, you know, that's being plotted here, is like the viewing angle like large compared to that opening angle, or is it?
Yes. Yeah, so the opening angle here would be 3 or 4 degrees, and we're looking at, you know, 20 or 30 degrees off axis right now.
Okay, so this difference is just that the top hat has like a really like infinitely steep, and the Gaussian is just like very steep, but not like infinitely steep, like a profile?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and the power law is shallower still.
Okay, great, thank you.
No problem. And so what's going on here? And what's happening, this is the last time you'll see this plot, I swear. If you have a structured jet like this, where you have a gradient of Lorentz factor and energy over the jet front, the beaming area that you can see initially is this little patch on the side here. And there's a gradient of Lorentz factor across this patch. It's brightest near the core. And as this jet decelerates, the tip of this sort of tracks inwards and inwards and inwards. So you see brighter and brighter material, which makes up for the fact that everything's decelerating, and you can get this sort of nice long slow decay. And people had even done some simulations of this for a while, but the slope of this line, how it depends on the parameters, was completely unknown. So this is some work that I did relatively recently, trying to figure this out. And the idea is that because this, you're always looking at some sort of small viewing patch, and your emission is dominated by sort of one individual patch of the jet with a particular Lorentz factor, you can imagine of your jet as a series of concentric top hats. And with time, you're sort of moving from top hat to top hat. And these top hat jets, we have very good analytic control over. So you can sort of glue them all together and actually figure out analytically what you expect the slope to be. So this was very, very, very cool. And it depends on some new parameter, which we just gave it a letter. And it depends on the viewing angle and the structure of the jet. So this sort of parameter G here encodes the structure of the jet and the viewing angle. And for a Gaussian jet, you get this nice particular combination. And so you can just sort of, and this is a very, very powerful tool. If you just were to see a jet like this out in the wild and you just read off its power law slope, you can see, oh, well, this is rising something like T to the 0.9 or so. You can immediately, if you assume that this is a Gaussian jet, just sort of pop that into this formula and figure out what this ratio of observer angle to core angle is. If you're not a Gaussian jet, if you're a power law jet or some other numerical model, this particular relationship will be different. The formula for the viewing angle, but this formula for the slope in terms of this G is universal for all structured jets. So in particular for 17817, you know, we can just do this by eye. I told you the slope was 0.9. This gives us a G of 8.2, which tells us that if you want to explain this by with a Gaussian shaped jet, your viewing angle has to be about 6 times the opening angle. And in fact, you'll see when we do sort of our fancier fits with a full numerical model, that's what we get. And that's what sort of many groups have achieved. So this was a fun sort of able to tackle this thing with pen and paper, as opposed to massive simulations. We did this sort of for all this relationship changes for all these different synchrotron bands, whether you're below or above the injection frequency, above or below the cooling frequency, whether the cooling frequency is above or below the injection frequency. There's all sorts of different parameters. And so we worked them all out here, big table of all these different slopes. If you have different jet models, so on the left-hand side, on the left-hand panel here, we see light curves for a Gaussian jet. On the right-hand side, we have numerical models for power law jets, where the energy goes like theta to some power, as opposed to a sort of Gaussian function. And the solid lines are numerical light curves computed with my model, and these dashed lines are this analytic approximation. And we can see it works quite well for many different viewing angles, and many different jet models. You can do a similar experiment and try to figure out how this jet break time and see how that scales with your viewing angle and opening angle for structured jets. We did this too, and we have formula for that. It's not terribly important, but they still go to this 8/3 power. This 8/3 power shows up all over in GRBs. But now from reading off the jet break time, we can sort of start to constrain the viewing angle and the opening angle still, even for structured jets. And these are all sorts of analytical tools that were only known for top hats until we figured them out relatively recently. And so with this, we can sort of come up with a sort of a generic picture for what we think afterglows should look like off axis. So, or as a function of viewing angle generically. So if your viewing angle is if you're inside this sort of core of the jet, then where the energy is sort of pretty smooth, then things should look more or less normal. You have sort of a you have a section before the jet break, section after the jet break, and all of our analytics that we've used for years work fine there. If you are sort of somewhere out in the wings, initially you might see a phase where you're so zoomed into the jet, it looks just like a regular GRB jet. Eventually, you're sensitive to this gradient of energy across your viewing surface, and that's the structured phase in the middle. And then finally, you're going to turn over and get a post-jet break phase at the end. And if you're far enough off axis, you'll see nothing initially, have a steep turn on like an orphan afterglow. And then you'll get a sort of smooth sort of structured phase and a post-jet break. And this is sort of, we think, a better picture of what we expect GRBs to look like out in the wild. So with any questions, I should take a quick pause here.
Sorry, can you remind me what is state W again?
Oh, I never told you. So that's a very good question. Theta W is we call it the wing angle. It's an outer truncation angle. So we think we have this sort of smooth profile, and then sort of we truncate it at some angle. This angle could be the equator, pi over two, but it could be somewhere else.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Have you actually applied those to data for long GRBs as well? So does your general jet models?
We have.
Or is there something to come?
Slide, okay. I have a slide on that
Good.
Coming up. Okay, I'll keep going. We built this model, of course, and we were inspired by this by 72817. We wrote this code to compute these models numerically, did the same sort of MCMC per parameter estimation. These models are a lot slower, but we were able to do it for a burst or two. And we get sort of a very nice fit to the 7 data. We can measure the opening angle to about a degree, the viewing angle to a couple degrees, and we see that this burst needs a total energy of 10 to the 50 ergs. Possibly more, possibly less, there's some uncertainty, but well within this 10 to the 52 erg limit for a magnetar. Which doesn't say that it is a magnetar, but it is not inconsistent with a magnetar. And we've been running this sort of as the data comes in. We've sort of had a few analyses of this. This is our sort of second most recent one. We do MCMC parameter estimation. So we get these full big posterior estimates for all of our parameters. And now, because we're fitting radio and optical data, we can actually sort of get some better constraints on these sort of synchrotron parameters as well. And everything looks very nice. And so from the GRB alone, we can measure the viewing angle, and in this case, we get something sort of on the order of 30 degrees. LIGO independently produces viewing angle estimates from the gravitational wave signal. And for this event, they got sort of 28 plus minus 15, and we were actually, I believe, the first group to incorporate the LIGO posteriors, and we used them as a prior. If we were able to combine the GW results with our electromagnetic data, which ends up shifting the posteriors and giving us tighter bounds on the viewing angle and energy. So using as many sources of data as possible, we can get the best constraints, of course. There's a bit of a hard point here. We would love to be able to just look at this data and read off the opening angle of the jet structure, and measure exactly sort of this distribution of energy and know everything about this jet and identify the central engine with a single burst. Unfortunately, this is very, very difficult. Our distribution of energy, this E theta function that we'd like to measure, is degenerate with the opening angle. So you can see one structure at some opening angle and a different structure at a different opening angle, and they will produce almost identical light curves. These big colored bands here are sort of constraints on this energy as a function of theta function for 72817. And the bands are showing sort of constraints as a function of different sort of cuts on the viewing angle. So if we take sort of our lowest quartile probability for the viewing angle, and we ask what could the energy be, we have to take the second quartiles, ask what could the energy be, and we see that there's many orders of magnitude to play with here, in for the energy of the peak and sort of how wide the jet is. All this depends a lot on the viewing angle. So incorporating things like LIGO data is critical to really nailing down this function. But even then, this is very hard to do with a single burst. There's a lot of degeneracy here. One thing we can possibly do is try to infer this function with a population of bursts. So this G parameter that we figured out for this slope is a function of the viewing angle and the jet structure, and it's going to be a different function for different bursts. So we can imagine making a plot like this of this G as a function of sort of this viewing angle to opening angle ratio. And you can think about this sort of like for a neutron star, these mass radius curves. Different equations of state produce different relationships between the neutron star mass and radius. And we're trying to measure mass and radius for different neutron stars to actually identify the equation of state. We can imagine doing a similar procedure for gamma ray bursts. If we can measure the slope for a number of off-axis GRBs and measure this viewing angle to core angle ray ratio, we may be able to start tracing out different paths in this space and identifying what sort of this jet structure distribution is. We would need to assume that they all have a similar jet structure or something, or do something more complicated. But there's with a population of bursts, you can do a lot more than with just one. I've been talking about these numerical models that we wrote. So this is all, this is sort of a few thousand lines of C all wrapped up in a conveniently callable Python function. This was the first public and open source tool for computing GRB afterglows sort of off-axis with sort of these generic structure profiles. You can install it right now if you care. If this is the sort of thing you're interested in, pip install afterglowpy on your command line. It should all work fine. And we're working on building up the documentation and building a new release with some more parameters. But we use this package. It doesn't do a full hydro simulation. It does do it sort of solves the shock jump conditions for the shock waves as a function of angle. It does this full integration over equal time of arrival surfaces with sort of flexible jet models and such. And it is free to use if you are so interested. Any quick questions? Okay, I'll march on. After all this work with 17817, we built this new, we have better analytic and numerical understandings. We're able to use this to start looking at at archival GRBs and find kilonova in past data. So this is the X-ray light curve for GRB 150101B. This one was a little funny. There's sort of, it takes a little bit to work through this image. This top panel here is the X-ray flux measured with the SWIFT instrument. And you can see that the data is the black bars and it's mostly flat. And so people looked at this and said, that's a weird looking GRB. The SWIFT emission is sort of flat. It was a short GRB and we didn't really know what to make of it at the time. They followed it up with Chandra. Chandra is a much more sensitive instrument that also measures X-rays. And Chandra has a finer angular resolution, and it was able to pick out the different that this GRB occurred right next to an AGN, an active galactic nuclei, which was also emitting X-rays. And on the bottom panel here, you see the Chandra data. The gray circles are the flux for this AGN, and these diamonds, we only have two of them, were what was associated with where it could identify the source of the GRB. If you take this AGN flux and put this on the SWIFT data, it sort of completely accounts for this baseline. So SWIFT was mainly just seeing the AGN. But if you take this Chandra data and sort of plot it backwards in time as we would expect a regular GRB to do, it should have been way brighter than the AGN at early times, and SWIFT didn't see that at all. So this is sort of a good candidate for sort of this suppressed early emission, sort of like an orphan afterglow. Not fully orphan, but there's evidence for sort of significant X-ray suppression at early times. And when we sort of, when you fit this with a model that can take into account viewing angle, you can subtract off the GRB, and there's a bit of an excess in the optical. We only have one data point, but it's a candidate. It's not a sort of a detection, but there is an excess in the optical, which is this little blue patch here, which looks very similar to the 17817 kilonova. At least it has the right magnitude. I say similar, but it's, we found a second candidate. This is a short GRB 16821b. It happens sort of away from its host galaxy. And this GRB, we had more optical and infrared data, and we were able to fit the X-ray and the radio with an afterglow model. I guess subtract that from the optical and infrared, and we saw that there was a there's again an excess. And the excess sort of starts blue and moves towards red, similar to what the 17817 kilonova did. So this is sort of the here in the solid red line is the 17817 kilonova data, which we have very good data on. And then these big orange circles are our observations with time for this GRB. And we see that sort of it tracks the same evolution, just sort of down by half a magnitude or so, but a very similar looking burst. So this was exciting. We don't need a LIGO to find kilonova. We see binary neutron star mergers all the time. We have hundreds of short GRBs in the archive. And so there's lots of data there to go mine once we have the models to subtract out the afterglow emission. And we have indeed started applying this to long GRBs. So this is work with a grad student, Ginny Cunningham at UMD. And she has this amazing, she compiled this amazing data set from the literature of this GRB 16625b. And there's so much data, we were able to tell the difference between sort of an on-axis top hat versus a mostly on-axis top hat versus a mostly on-axis Gaussian jet. And sort of the structured jet was preferred at about the three sigma level. And this one appears to have a total energy on the order of 10 to the 53 ergs, which is above the magnetar limit. But this is a little degenerate with some other synchrotron parameters, which we don't have a great understanding on. So it's hard to tell for this one, but it's a very interesting burst. As I said, all GRB jets should be structured jets. And so if we want to learn about this jet structure and sort of the mechanism that launches these jets, we can look at long GRBs too. We don't only have to look at binary neutron stars. Looking forward, I'll just run on. I think I have about 30 more seconds. Oh, I have negative 30 seconds, but I'll do this up quick. LIGO 04 is scheduled to start in 2022. You know, who knows exactly when it'll start, but we're going to get more gravitational wave observations in the future. New electric, but we made 17817 was incredibly lucky. It was the nearest short GRB we've ever seen, and it was also aligned towards us so that the emission, we could see all of these bright components, and we may not get that lucky in the future. Our data may be sparser, it may be dimmer, there'll be lots of upper limits, so we really shouldn't waste photons. Every photon is precious. So what we need to do is right now we're using these sort of flexible models. We don't really know what the structure of these jets should be. So we're parameterizing simple models and fitting those to data. What we really need to do is sort of couple progenitor models to build self-consistent structured jets. We can do full numerical simulations of these jets as they turn into afterglows. We can use a program like ScaleFit to turn these numerical simulations into very fast afterglow evaluations, and we can fit that to data. This is sort of our most recent work on 17817, and recently, the most recent observation in X-rays was a little bit brighter than we expected it to be. And with time, we actually expect that the kilonova ejecta can actually begin making its own afterglow. And this is something that might turn on in the next few years. And sort of with more data, we'll be able to, we may be able to detect and put limits on sort of the velocity stratification within this ejecta, which would be very neat. But this sort of brings home the point that this is one data set, and the kilonova and these GRB are coupled events, and they affect each other. They affect the overall mission together. And we should really be looking at all of them as one holistic event. We need to start sort of not just fitting these afterglows, but also simultaneously fitting kilonova models and other emission sources and taking into account sort of observational uncertainties that can occur. This is some preliminary work I'm working on with grad student Brendan O'Connor. And so he found a GRB, he didn't find there. We found a GRB, it's been reported. It also had an optical excess, which looks like a kilonova. And we were actually able to fit an afterglow model with a blackbody model for the kilonova and compare the blackbody fluxes to kilonova models from Los Alamos. And to explain this emission, you need a very energetic kilonova with something like with 3 to 10% of the solar mass of wind ejecta, which is a little crazy. But you can also explain this, it turns out, by putting a moderate amount of dust in the host galaxy. This sort of changes this sort of color problem in the emission, and this also sort of explains the data equally well. There's no statistical difference between having a kilonova or just having some extra dust. So we need to take these sorts of things into account in order to get sort of robust estimates of objects in the future. And finally, we have a lot of GRBs with mysterious central engines that we don't have gravitational wave detections for, and we should continue looking and learn as much as we can from those in the meantime. Okay, and with that, I'm well over time. I'll just sort of pop up my summary and end. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Geoffrey, for this fantastic talk. Are there any more questions? We already had quite some discussion, but I'm sure there are some more questions right now. Yes, Luis?
Geoffrey, in the spirit of not wasting any photons, now, given what you know now, so how much more, I would say, less aligned could GW17 or A17 have been, and still you would have been able to catch up the signals? We would have been able to catch up the signals.
How far off axis could it have been for us to detect the afterglow?
No, I'm not. I don't want to push it. No, I don't care about so much about the afterglow. I want to see the higher frequency range, the higher energies. So I don't want to push it further. I just want to misalign it more with respect to us and observer. So as from the point of view of what you know of the jet, the structure, etc., how much can I tilt the orbital plane of the binary and still see the high energy EM side?
Right. I mean, this is going to depend a little bit on instruments, because our instruments are getting better, so they're going to be detecting fainter things in the future. But we probably, based on this one, I don't think we could go more than if we were more, a few more degrees off axis. Sort of this one we think was 20 degrees. If we were much past 30, I think it would have been quite dim. But we don't know exactly how this affects the prompt emission, the gamma rays. This depends a little bit on how the gamma rays were produced. And so if we have a gamma ray emission mechanism, we can figure out what that looks like off axis, but we don't know always what the gamma ray the actual gamma ray emission mechanism is. So we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And related to the other comment you had, so this potential kilonova that you need a whopping amount of ejecta. Has anyone been thinking about, again, so maybe the more astrophysicist minded community does not like to think of smaller black hole, but maybe an equal mass black hole neutron star merger, or a very much lower mass ratio, or much more closer to one mass ratio could do that. But I guess the astro community it's not fond of a black hole with less than 3 solar masses or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I personally am fine with that. that would be interesting. Right now from the data, you know, it could be this sort of whopping kilonova, or it could be dust. And it's a lot, you know, by Occam's razor, unless the data were pointing much more towards the kilonova, I would like to call it dust.
Thank you.
But certainly, you know, this is the sort of things that have to be taken into account. And if we see, and we'll be seeing a lot more kilanova in the future. So hopefully we'll have an idea if this is common or not.
Thank you.
So Jaffe, you're alluding to this, I believe, was it it was an APJ letter, I think, Fong et al, this kilanova produced potentially by a magnetar, right? So that's the other paper that you're alluding to, right?
In the front. Yes, yeah. I think I had it in the corner. Wenfei Fong at Northwestern has been studying this GRP with their team. They also find out this bright excess, and they suggest that you could power the kilanova, you could brighten up the kilanova with a magnetar, which is certainly possible.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions for Jaffe? I have like one just quick detailed question. So what kind of parameters are you also fitting for the electron index P for your afterglow blast waves? And if so, what kind of values do you get for those values? Because I remember some discussion about this a few years ago when just GW17 or H17 happened, and there was some debate about whether or not these P values were physical in some models.
Yeah. So we get a P of about for GW17 and 17, we get a P of about 2.17. It's dropped a little bit with the most recent detection, 2.15 or so. We always fit for that. That's actually one of the easiest parameters to fit for, because it locks on the slope of the spectrum of the emission is sort of depends linearly on P. So if you can get this power law slope, you can nail P really easily. And yeah, those for 17.17, I think it's perfectly reasonable to have a P of 2.2 and just let that be that, or 2.17. There's some GRBs appear to like the fits sort of get driven to really really low P's, like 2.01, which seems a little bit weird. People think that P should be bigger than 2, so that's sort of getting near a bound. But you know, we don't really. That's sort of getting into the limits, into the weeds of how the synchrotron works.
Okay, thanks. Great. Okay, any final questions or thoughts? If not, I think it's getting late. So maybe we'll call it a seminar here at this point. Jaffe and I will still stay here on the call for another couple of minutes if people just want to chat a little more and ask a couple more questions or just start some informal chat. Other than that, thanks a lot, everyone, and see you next week.